Blog Talk Radio.
Well, good evening, everyone. This is Carl from ISF and Films and Stuff podcast. And tonight we're very happy to welcome back one of our favorite guest panelists, Patrick Crane from Oklahoma City. Patrick, nice to have you with us.
It's great to be here, Carl. Thank you again for having me on.
Oh, absolutely. So the reason we have Patrick on is that we had him scheduled last week to do the Larry Cohen retrospective. And he had written a lot of essays on Cohen. And so I invited him on. And then like 2 days before the podcast, he contacts me and says, well, I got this opportunity and I'm afraid I'm going to have to back out. And he told me what the opportunity was. And I said, by all means, back out. So why don't you tell us what happened, Mr. Crane?
Okay. So, yeah, and it was the Val Lewton podcast with Danny Perry that I missed. We did the Cohen podcast.
Oh, yeah, Val Lewton.
So
that's it.
We had two podcasts kind of scheduled right on top
of each other. That's it.
And we, and then we did the Cohen podcast, and then I was asked, Lloyd Kaufman was coming to Oklahoma City to promote the new Troma movie, his new Troma movie, Shakespeare Shitstorm. And he stresses that the title is actually hashtag Shakespeare Shitstorm. So he was coming to do a promotional, he's doing a promotional tour with that, and he was coming to a theater, a historic theater that we still have standing in Oklahoma City called Rodeo Cinema in Stockyard City. And I'm associated with the Oklahoma Film Society, and they needed somebody to do the Q&A. And so they called me up out of the blue, or at least my friend called me up out of the blue. They had asked him to ask me. And so I reluctantly agreed to do it. But it turned out to be a really great opportunity, and it was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed it. That was a great experience, for sure.
Reluctantly, if they had asked me, I said, fuck yeah, I'll do that. I bet you it was a blast.
I was just
talking to him.
Oh, yeah, no, and it had to do with the fact that it had been a very long time since I had, dipped into Troma. And I wasn't certain if I was going to be able to kind of get up to snuff to do a Q&A, because when I was asked, I had no clue as to the format or how many questions I'd be asking, how long it would last or any of these things. So I wanted to make sure I was prepared, and then, as is my wont to do, I over-prepared and dived into the deep end of the Troma pool. I had some titles lying around in my library, but I quickly went out and obtained and acquired all the Troma titles that I could that were tangentially Lloyd Kaufman related, and I set to absorbing all of those. I think I went through about half of his book in about a week's time. So I sort of overdosed on Troma there for a week just to be ready. And I'm sort of glad that I did, because whenever I met him, and I met him, about 2 hours before the show, he was doing a meet and greet in the lobby, and I got some time to spend with him. All of that stuff was fresh on my mind. So when we had, when we were speaking, I was sort of on top of things, and I felt like I'd really, really studied for the exam and really did well. So I was sort of proud of myself, and I found my trip to Tromaville ultimately a very rewarding experience, and I had a really good time doing it. So it was sort of a double win for me all around.
Nice, nice. So tell us a little bit about the night and the theater and how that all worked out and how many people were there and so on and so forth.
Well, as is the general, I guess, on the way that Troma works or the way that Kaufman works, I guess in each region he has sort of people that are there that kind of go on the tour with him. And you know, you have people in character, and then people that are in those towns that he shows up in, they will show up and be part of the support, if not in costume and as cheerleaders of some kind. I mean, Troma is a very interesting company, but so when they came to Oklahoma City, it was just, it's to promote this newest movie, which I think came out in 2020. He does a meet and greet. It's a lot like a convention atmosphere. If you've ever been to any of these horror conventions, and the line is only for Lloyd Kaufman, and he is just very gracious with his fans, because he's very aware that Troma is nothing without those fans. And he was adamant about, the movie was supposed to start at 8, but, the line was still going, and we didn't start the movie until he had exhausted that line and everybody got their fair time with him. And he was not, he wasn't at all pushy or wasn't at all agitated. He was high energy. But Lloyd Kaufman is just a pro. I mean, that's what really I got the sense of, just what kind of he's sort of a professional goof, and a lot of that is turn on and turn off, but he has right. such a manic energy that's very infectious. And I mean, Lloyd Kaufman is like, if you, he's very bright, he's a Yale graduate, so Troma is a little bit of an extension of him, which is like if you took National Lampoon and Mad Magazine and then the EC Comics that were the original horror right. comics, and you put them all in a blender, you'd get Troma. And it's a wild company that makes movies that are so broadly pitched to the widest audience, yet they're so incredibly specific. They can only come from one place. And so it generates a certain kind of crowd and a certain kind of fan base, but they're very loving and very rabid, and they're a lot of fun. And the theater, I don't know how many, the theater is decent size. It's a decent sized house. We sold out the VIP tickets, and we did pretty well on the general admission tickets. And what was nice was, I think he had come from a show the night before that didn't do so well. So it was nice that when he came into Oklahoma City that he got such a warm response that the people in the crowd were as engaged as they were. The questions during the Q&A were really good. That he appreciated, and everybody responded to the movie really well. So it was a really good night for Lloyd Kaufman, and it was a really good night for Oklahoma City, as we because that's generally not the place you think. This isn't the kind of place you think that a Troma event would go over well. But we have our weirdos out here.
I think there are weirdos everywhere, seriously, and certainly. Troma is very, very well regarded as an independent, and it's all Kaufman. Now, when we talked about this previously, and I think it was you, it might have been Tony Strauss, tell us a little bit about the film itself, Shakespeare Shitstorm, or hashtag Shakespeare Shitstorm, and tell us what you think of that.
Well, I liked it a lot. It's very daring in a certain kind of way. It's based off of The Tempest. So this is Lloyd Kaufman's second adaptation of a Shakespeare work, first being Romeo and Juliet. But it's based off of The Tempest, and it's set in a sort of a fantastical, heightened reality, where social justice warriors and environmentalists and outrage culture and cancel culture all meet in this giant sort of fecal-encrusted apocalyptic boat ride thing, or not boat ride, but it starts on a boat ride where everybody gets slaughtered in whale shit.
But Tempest, yeah,
but it's but yes, it takes on a lot of edgy ideas, you know, in this particular culture, which are very close to Lloyd Kaufman's heart, because, you know, this is obviously a guy who has spent his career making movies of a certain kind of quality that, you know, are purposefully lowbrow and, toilet humor and just scattergun offensiveness. The thing about Troma is that obviously nobody is spared at all. That's the one thing about them. You know, they're not singling out anybody. They single out everybody. I mean, everybody gets it in the Troma movies. But, of course, you know, how does that stuff play in, with today's audiences is kind of a question. And, Lloyd Kaufman gets to sort of address that in Shakespeare's Shitstorm. And I love it. I appreciate that he remains who he is. And I appreciate that even if all humor is not going to be for everybody. And some humor is just going to be vulgar, and some humor is going to be offensive. But Lloyd Kaufman is unapologetic in where he's coming from. And his heart, he always wants to make sure that everybody understands his heart's in the right place. And for that, you allow him a lot of grace. And then so this movie, which I think in somebody else's hands may come off as being glib and a little tone deaf, I think it's just perfect for Lloyd Kaufman. And one further, I think Shakespeare's Shitstorm actually shows Lloyd Kaufman to be maybe just a little bit more of an auteur than he says, than he thinks. He's a businessman for sure, but he's like what happened. He's like if Herschel Gordon Lewis would have been a talented filmmaker. Because Herschel Gordon Lewis was like, he knew how to market, but he didn't know how to make a movie. Lloyd Kaufman knows how to make a movie, more or less. And I think he achieves a certain level of, class, if that, for lack of a better term, with this movie, which he states will be his last film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I understand. Now, I need to tell you a couple things, okay? So first the whole idea of meeting Lloyd Kaufman, well, he's coming to New York City. And, of course, I'm right outside the city in Elmont. And I'm thinking very, very seriously about going to the premiere of Shakespeare's Shitstorm at the Museum of the Moving Image. Now, if anyone comes across this, wherever they are listening, would you suggest them to go see the film? Or with caveats,
sure.
If you need to?
Well, I mean, with caveats, I mean, with Troma, listen, I mean, if you don't know Troma, then you might want to bone up to see if you want to go to it, because, I mean, but if you understand Troma's playbook, then it's going to be what you think it is. But no, it's offensive humor. It's this kind of stuff. Troma has always been the one company that has always bucked the adage: you can't make that kind of movie anymore. You can't do that kind of thing anymore on screen, or that, you know, like people that say that about Blazing Saddles. So you couldn't make that today. Well, Troma makes that kind of stuff today, and they are, you know, like I said, completely unapologetic about it. But again, just like Mel Brooks, you know, their hearts are in the right place. You know, this is good-natured, mean-spiritedness, I guess you could say. But yes, I would suggest seeing it. But my caveat is this: when I finally saw Shakespeare's Shitstorm, it was at the tail end of a full week binge of nothing but Troma movies. So by that point, I'd been completely taken hostage. And so, you know, I was completely in that groove to where I was digging it. I was on that wavelength, and I, And I sort of got where he was coming from. Had I not done all that homework beforehand and just gone in and watched it cold, I probably would have found it a little, oh, wow, this is a little abrasive or confrontational, I guess, or, you know. But, I had to remind myself that this is the Troma brand. And also that if you watch it incrementally, you know, from the late 70s with the sex comedies all the way up to Shakespeare Shitstorm, you know, you see how on brand they are with every single movie and how it is sort of an unchanging model. And so, you know, when you get used to that, everything seems to be fine. But yeah, if you were to just kind of pick one out cold, especially this one, yeah, I mean, you may have some problems.
Now, I also need to tell you that as far as Shakespeare is concerned, my favorite play has always been Tempest. Okay, and the Tempest. And so I am very interested in what Lloyd Kaufman is going to do with that. I mean, there have been several adaptations, and I've actually seen it on stage, my favorite being the Paul Mazursky film from 1982. But this boggles my mind. Now, I did finally see Romeo and Juliet, and that was, whoa. So did you get a chance to see Romeo and Juliet?
Yeah, I watched almost everything that he directed. The only thing I didn't see before I went up there was I did not get a chance to see the fourth Toxic Avenger movie. But yeah, I watched everything else, and so I watched Romeo and Juliet, and I think that's his best film. I thought that was wild. I thought it was inspired. I thought it was fun. I thought I laughed, and I thought that it was just, I thought it was clever.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, I did too. I was very impressed with that. It almost seems like, you know, if he's adapting Shakespeare, he actually might pull back a little bit. I know that's kind of hard to understand if you see Romeo and Juliet and he's like, what, he pulled back? But I actually believe that. I think he has a respect for the, if not the exact text, the plot and the point of view of this. So that's why I'm really interested in seeing this, because I love The Tempest. I love that play.
I'll be interested to see what you think of it. I think you'll like it. It's pretty wild. William Kaufman is in a double role, I should say. Also, he plays the Prospero character. He plays his sister, so he's in a dual role, playing a male and female. Going back to Romeo and Juliet, one of the reasons that is so good probably is due somewhat to the screenplay by James Gunn, who has gone on to do all kinds of stuff. And, you know, but Romeo and Juliet is, you know, is touched with a certain special magic that the rest of his movies don't quite have. I may have to attribute that to Gunn, but I'm not sure if that's all him or if it's part Shakespeare. Or if just everybody's, you know, was firing on all cylinders when they made that movie. But, I do think that is, their best film. I don't know where I would put Shakespeare, Shitstorm, but, it's one of their better films.
So now, in when you did the Q&A with Lloyd, was there a question answer that you provided and he provided that surprised you, or did you sort of expect what he was going to say?
I think I was mostly relieved that he didn't think I was an idiot.
You are not an idiot, Patrick. Trust me on that.
Well, you know, I mean, it's different to like sit here and like, you know, be able to, you know, look things up as I'm, you know, sort of going off or if I'm writing something and researching. But, you know, when you're sitting there on the spot and you have to banter back and forth in front of a crowd, and by the way, that was my first Q&A I'd ever done, so I wasn't sure exactly what to expect. I was just kind of relieved that, you know, that it went as seamlessly as it did. I think the one question he got that he appreciated most was somebody asked him, like, if he were to do another movie, it was a Shakespeare adaptation, what would he do? And I think he was alluding to that he would do Macbeth. But The Tempest, I believe he said, was his favorite piece. And indeed, he talked a great deal about his respect for Shakespeare and went to, you know, he was not necessarily at great pains to explain to everybody that, yes, I went to Yale, I am a smart guy, you know, even though these are the movies I make. You know, he did go on a little bit about his love for Shakespeare and his reverence for it. So, you know, I think he was pleased that he got that question. I asked him, I said, well, you know, now that you've made two, you're sort of in rarefied company with, like, Orson Welles, because you made two Shakespeare adaptations. And I think I asked him something about, like, how proud he was to have been, you know, part of an organization now that's going to be next year 50 years old, where there have been no real limits as to what you can make and what you can do and sort of the creative atmosphere. And I'll tell you what, I don't remember a thing about what he said. So I was sort of on an autopilot, just trying to, you know, because I was so nervous. But, you know, it went over really well. And he was, again, what I can remember of my exchanges with him, which were more the ones I had with him before the show started, were you know, very good and whatnot. But, yeah, on the stage it was, or, you know, in front of the crowd, it was kind of a blur a little bit.
Yeah, I can understand that. Now, how did the audience react to the film and to him? Now, you mentioned that a lot of them were in costume and so on and so forth. So are we talking a real rowdy crowd, or once the film started, did they settle down or they laugh like crazy at it?
Yeah, the people I knew, you know, some of the people that came out are people that I know. And so, you know, when some of the more outre and transgressive moments in the film occurred, as would happen and as happened in all of Troma's films, there was a lot of, you know, screaming and cheering and laughing. And, you know, so, yeah, the crowd was very game and I think he appreciated that quite a bit because, you know, again, I think coming from the night he had before, I'm sure his expectations were probably in a certain check. So, but yeah, no, they were very, very engaged, and they seemed to really, really love the movie. I'm really looking forward to watching it again where I don't have to think about, okay, what am I going to ask him after? Should I bring this up? Or, you know, when I was watching the movie, I was like, right, oh, should I change this around? You know, whatnot. So I was a little distracted, but I'm really looking forward to watching it again because I watched it and I absorbed it and I got it, but I was a little distracted. So I'm looking forward to watching it again, sort of with a more peaceful mindset. But yeah, no, the crowd, you know, they came to party, and a party they got.
Nice. That's good to hear. I'm as I said, I'm thinking seriously going to see it. excuse me, he's going to be here April 8th for Q&A. So I'm thinking very strongly about going. So you did a lot of preparation for this. And I thought, at the very least, while we're talking about Lloyd Kaufman and Troma, we should at least give our listeners a little bit of background. And he did go to Yale. And he did a number of films. his first directed film was 1969. But what's really interesting to me is he went to work for Cannon Films, and he met John Appleton, and he co-produced both Joe and Cry Uncle. And a lot of people don't realize some of his early work. He also was executive in charge of locations for Saturday Night Fever and was influential in choosing 2001 Odyssey as the nightclub for the film. He co-wrote Sugar Cookies, which we'll talk about briefly because I know you watched that, with Oliver Stone. He even did, now I'm sure you did mention this, but he even did some hardcore sex films under the pseudonym of Louis Sue. So he's been in the business for quite a while. And he learned his craft. And he then connected with Michael Hertz, and they formed Troma. And, you know, I mean, really, from there on in, I'm going to give it to you because I know you watch most of the films. Do you want to just, like, mention a couple of his films that you either really liked or that you think that people should check out?
Yeah. First of all, Troma was a pickup company, and it was formed in 74 while he was working for Cannon. They had offices. He and Hertz went to Yale together. But that's the Troma, you know, office and the Troma business was, they were mostly just a company that would pick up movies and distribute them. And the first one they did was Bloodsucking Freaks in 76. Which is pretty notorious and not very good. But then the first movie that the first in-house movie they made, which was co-directed by Kaufman and Hertz, and Kaufman at this point was taking a pseudonym director credit by the name of, something
Michael
sure.
Muir or something
like
name
that?
Hold on.
Samuel
I got
Schur.
It for you.
Samuel Schur.
Samuel
yeah,
Weill.
Sam
Samuel
Schur.
Weill.
Samuel. Oh, okay. Right. So
Samuel
the Weill. First movie they did was what?
Squeeze Play, right?
Yeah, Squeeze Play. Now Squeeze Play I have a history with. And I don't even know if I knew that was a Troma movie until, I mean, like maybe 10 years ago. Squeeze Play happens to be probably the first motion picture where that I saw nudity in. And the reason I saw it was because I was staying the night at a friend's house. I was probably 9 or 10, probably 9, and his mother played softball. She was on a, you know, like a company softball league. And so this movie about these women softball players versus these men softball players were going to be playing. It was going to be playing on HBO. So we were all going to sit around and watch this. You know that it was rated R. That didn't matter to them. It didn't. But the minute that movie came on, like one of the first things you see is a woman's boob being squeezed, and she jumped up so fast to turn that thing off that I had to see this movie. Like I couldn't. So like I think a few years later, I saw it. I came on like USA Up All Night. I taped it, and I remember watching it, knowing how cut up it was, and just I was like, oh, I wish I could see an uncut version of this. So, you know, because this is not the movie that I know that it is. So I think about 10 years ago, I found it on DVD and bought it and watched it. It's not great, but I have an affinity for it. I don't know. I have a real, I'm a sucker for that particular formula that was hot in the late 70s, which is, you know, group of women form X and take on the male chauvinists that are doing the same thing. And you see it a lot in sex comedies. You see it a lot in porn too. Hot and Saucy, Pizza Girls, Taxi Girls, Garage Girls, you know, These are all movies with basically the same formula. And so Squeeze Play is kind of that too. And I have a soft spot for it. It's raunchy. It's toilet humor. It's, you know, it's boobs and butts and all, you know, whatever. But there's a certain kind of charm to those movies and quaintness now, you know, X number of years later. And I think of all of their little sex comedies, I think it's my favorite one. So Squeeze Play would be one that I'd recommend all of these things with caveats, by the way. There's not a one of these movies, except maybe The Toxic Avenger and Romeo and Juliet, that I would say you could watch cold without any sort of preparation. But other than Squeeze Play, you know, obviously I think The Toxic Avenger is an easy wormhole for people to get into with trauma. The first one is a lot of fun. It hooked me when I was 13.
I need to talk about The Toxic Avenger because an acquaintance of mine by the name of Gary Schneider, who was a very good friend of mine, Ray Laudo, we used to go out on Fridays or Saturdays and like hit the town, and I'm in my 20s at this point, mid-20s. And so Gary was an actor, as was Ray, and he played the main bad guy in Toxic Avenger. His name's Gary Schneider. And so through Gary, I was able to attend the New York premiere and after party of The Toxic Avenger. I don't remember much of it. Let's just say I don't, because there was illicit drugs and lots of alcohol involved. But I can tell you this, I had a friggin' blast.
Well, yeah.
I love the movie. I love that film.
Oh, yeah. It's still so much fun. And, you know, again, you watch it. And the thing about trauma is there's humor. The humor in trauma movies can range from literally slipping on a banana peel all the way to the most obscure, clever, inside baseball film reference imaginable. I mean, it runs such a broad gamut that I have nothing but respect for the wild mind of Lloyd Kaufman and Michael Herz. I mean, it just really is. It's really kind of an amazingly broad scope of material that they stuff into their movies. And I think that each Toxic Avenger movie is really good. I think they're all fun. I think they are all unique in their own special way. I don't think any of them are as good as the first one, but I still think the second and the third one are great. And I also think the fourth one is good. I've seen it since the thing happened. So I was also, you know, Terror Firmer, which is the movie that Lloyd made, which is about the making of a trauma movie. And it's got a serial killer or giallo kind of thing going through it, a little subplot going through it. I was watching that movie and I was like, you know, I'm not trying to put it down. This movie was very reminiscent of Hollywood Boulevard.
We're going to be doing with my former partner on his network. We're going to do a watch of Hollywood Boulevard. But yes, I've always said that Terror Firmer is his version of Hollywood Boulevard, without a doubt.
Right. I told him that, and I mean, I can't imagine that's the first time he's heard that, but, you know, he acted like it was. So I said that would make a good double feature, you know, given that they're both about, you know, making movies at independent studios with an actual horror subplot weaving through it, you know. So I actually really like Terror Firmer. I hate to admit that I actually really thought Poultry Geist was funny. I hate to say that, but I did. And
I did not like Poltergeist. Did not like it.
You did not. You did not like it.
Went overboard.
Yeah, it does go overboard, but it, for whatever reason, I don't know. I don't know why. I think that was about the point where I was really. Huh?
I can understand that.
You know, you get to a point where you get sort of giddy with some of these things, and especially when you, you know, there's a repeating gag that he does with a car that does this barrel roll, and it comes from Sergeant Kabuki Man, NYPD. That's where it originates. But it's a really great car stunt. And, you know, this car ramps up all over this other car, does a barrel roll in the air, and then comes to rest. And then it switches to another shot where the car explodes. It starts in Sergeant Kabuki Man, NYPD, and then he uses it in every single movie after that. And even if he cannot find a way to put it in there, he will go on a tangent to get it in there. And what's funny about Poltergeist is that it goes the whole movie without this gag. And it's the last thing in the movie. They get away from everybody, and then they get in this car wreck, which so they can use the barrel roll, and the car explodes. I love it. I fucking laughed my ass off. I mean, I laughed so hard my wife commented on it. I don't laugh that hard. So I think I was at that point where these things were becoming, I was just getting sort of silly and punch drunk off of them, and everything just seemed to land just right because I found myself in that right rhythm. Because, you know, mm-hmm. I even liked the Return to Nukem High Volume 1. I thought that was pretty clever and funny. I thought that was better than the Class of Nukem High.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Gary was also in that film, too. Not in a prominent role, though. But, the one thing you're talking about, the barrel roll, That we were talking about Hollywood Boulevard, which is Joe Dante and Alan Arkin. But Joe Dante always had this thing with the helicopter explosion that he would put in all the trailers when he was working for trailers for New World. And no matter what, the Young Nurses, there's a helicopter explosion. I don't care what it is. There's a helicopter explosion. So, yeah, it's sort of the same
right.
gag.
Yeah, I mean,
what I was going to say is maybe when I'm at the Lloyd Kaufman Q&A, I'll come up with that and see what he says about I'm just going to ask, like, do you like Joe Dante movies? There's a reason I asked that.
Right.
Maybe I shouldn't.
Yeah. I don't know. He's, you know, I'll tell you what, though. I was glad that I didn't ask him about Street Trash. You know the movie Street Trash?
Yeah, I
Have
do
you ever
know.
Seen that one?
I know. I've seen it. I don't know his connection to it, though.
At least I don't know of a connection. I think he talks about it at some point in his book. But there's some beef with that filmmaker because he mentions that in the book about how there's something that he does not like about that filmmaker and Street Trash. My guess would be that Street Trash is very much like a trauma movie. You know, I mean, if you watch it, it's basically a trauma movie. Well, I was going to ask him about movies that were inspired by trauma, and I was going to bring up Trash, but I never got to ask him this question. I'm glad I didn't, because like 2 days later I'm reading more in his book, and apparently that's when I read that he just hates this director and hates Street Trash. I'm glad I didn't even ask him that, but you know, I like Street Trash.
You mentioned very briefly Sergeant Kabuki Man, and that's probably my second favorite of all his films. And I do know that in the book, he actually admits that there was a mistake with that, because originally that was going to be his first PG movie. But then he decided to go full trauma on it. And years later, he actually admitted that that was a mistake. I love Sergeant Kabuki, man. I just love that film, even in its in the form of Zen. It's a one, you know, there's a heart to it. And that's the one thing about him. You look at some of his, there's a lot of heart there. There's a lot of stick, too, that you've got to get through. But there's heart there, too. There's no question of that.
Oh, definitely. I mean, you know, definitely. And in the case of Sergeant Kabuki Man, yeah, I mean, you can tell that he pulls some punches there. That movie does seem a little bit softer than, you know, what came before and what comes after. But back to, like, I think his level of humor, which I think is so canny, the one of the funniest things about Sergeant Kabuki Man is at the beginning of the movie where all the stuff's going to go down at this Kabuki Theater play, and the play they're putting on is The Odd Couple in Kabuki.
Right.
And what's funny about it is they're not doing The Odd Couple the play. They're not doing The Odd Couple the movie. They're doing a play based on The Odd Couple the TV show, because there's one person with a Kabuki mask that is the face of the cop, the Al Molinario character. And I was laughing my ass off about that little bit of detail, that they're doing this Odd Couple play, but it's really The Odd Couple the TV show. And I thought that was I thought that was fucking hilarious. But yeah, I do love Sergeant Kabuki Man. And you're right, it has a lot of heart. You know, as does Toxic Avenger, and you know, Trauma's all about the underdog, and you know, and it's all about, you know, it's got that kind of heart to it, because that's them, right? That's what they are. They're the underdog. They're the scrappers, you know, and so they love their lovable box of, you know, broken toys, you know, of characters, and their you know, cut and paste shared universe that he's kind of created in the vein of Marvel Comics. And that was the other thing that I love about Troma, was that, you know, for years Marvel sort of tried to, how could we make movies and how could we make a cinematic universe that was connected? And I like that Troma kind of did that, showed them how to do that first a little bit. I mean, they're same thing. But yeah. Troma was the first, you know, they really went in on their characters as brands, you know, and did, you know, and they crossed over into each other's movies and popped up here, you know, in shared videos and stuff. And I really, you know, I it's not, you know, again, not quite the same thing, but, you know, it's not nothing either. I mean, Troma did that on a budget, you know, with just imagination and glue and paint and whatever, whatever cheap effects they could do, you know, so. So yeah.
The other thing I want to bring up too, as we start to wind this up, is that Lloyd Kaufman, you know, we talk about the Troma films and what he's directed and all this, but let's not forget they're a distributor too, and they've done some really interesting things over the years. They were the first. Though they were not successful, they were the first to distribute Ghibli films here in the U.S. There are films that I love, such as Christmas Evil, which they distribute. And they distribute Buddy Giovinazzo's film. And just they really, really do a lot with that, and yeah, some of them are cheap. Well, most of them are cheap, but he has an eye for talent. He really does, and I just want people to understand that too. It's not just you know, he's a businessman. He knows what he's doing. Seriously, like Herschel Gordon Lewis, we talked about him and his direct marketing. They know how to market. They know how to do this business. And you know, you look at some of the early stuff he did and some of the stuff he distributes and what he's done with Troma and everything, and you look at some of the people that have come out of it, you know, like James Gunn. I mean, it's a real, real, it's almost like a film school if you get involved. It's a film school. You learn this stuff.
Oh, yeah.
By doing.
Oh, yeah. He talks a great deal about that in his book. And, you know, I mean, trauma is you learn everything about the business. If you want to learn everything there is about the business, you know, go to trauma because they'll teach you. I mean, because they do so much, they're vertically integrated pretty much, you know, and they don't pre-sell their movies and all of that. So, you know, they're just, and back to, you know, the things that they've distributed that I've enjoyed, they also, they distributed, although not great, Dario Argento's Stendhal Syndrome on the DVD in America. They had that one. And they were the first to give a home video release of Brian De Palma's movie The Wedding Party, which is his true first film from the early 60s with Robert De Niro and Jill Clayburgh. Trauma actually put that out on DVD. So they have, you know, done third-party titles. And I said earlier, Blood-Sucking Freaks is one of their biggest ones. And, you know, of course, Certain Nazis Must Die and the Taint.
Okay. We got to talk about Surf Nazis Must Die. I freaking love that movie. I adore that film.
I've never seen it. I was trying to get that one watched, but I had to make decisions. And since he didn't direct it or write it, it was just a pickup film. I chose to watch it afterwards. But I'm going to get to it. And let's see, what's the other one that they? What's the other one that they did? Father's Day, which I love, which is the Astro Six gang out of Canada. I really love Father's Day. I really love Astron 6. Astron 6 is a lot like Trauma, though. They're very trauma-inspired, so, you know. But, yeah, and then we were going to talk, before we wrap up, obviously we're going to talk a little bit about Sugar Cookies.
Let's take your take, and then I'll give you mine. Okay.
So Sugar Cookies is a movie that he did not direct, but he wrote it. He was the executive producer. He gave Oliver Stone an associate producer credit. Lloyd Kaufman also co-wrote some of the lyrics for one of the songs in it. And then he also cast his father in it, who he plays the lawyer to the movie star guy. Or something. He plays a lawyer. He's on the phone in the movie. But and Sugar Cookies is basically a sort of softcore lesbian Vertigo movie. But I really like it. Lynn Lowry is really great in it, and of course Mary Warnoff is incredible in anything she's in. And the movie is actually directed by her then husband, Theodore Guarneschi. I don't know how you pronounce this guy.
Theodore Guarneschi.
Yeah, but they made Silent Night, Bloody Night together after Sugar Cookies, which is another movie I love. But Sugar Cookies is sort of it's not like a lost masterpiece or anything, but it's really worth searching out. Vinegar Syndrome did a nice Blu-ray of it I think it's got a video introduction or video interview with Lloyd Kaufman, and it's a truly interesting film, and I'm a fan of it because of course I like that's like kind of in my wheelhouse, that type of cinema and that particular vintage. I think it's like 1973 or 4.
Yeah, exactly, and I'm with you on that. That's my vintage and my years. Absolutely, I agree. For me, anyone who knows me and follows me either on my post at ISF or my personal post knows how much I am in love with Mary Warnoff. To this day, I would marry that woman in a heartbeat, even though she would say, no, I don't care. I have been a fan for years. And I saw Sugar Cookies after I saw Death Race 2000. But I did see it, and I could not believe what I was seeing. She just is one of the most dynamic presences. And I'm not just talking sexually or anything like that. She Go ahead, Pat.
No, absolutely. Somebody was watching it the other day on Twitter, and they posted a scene of her when she's talking to the cop. And I said, when Mary Warnoff passes away, when she passes, you're going to have to buy a whole separate cemetery plot just for her screen presence. It's so huge. I mean, like, when she's on screen, she eats it alive in everything she's in. I don't know what it is, but I think the word is striking.
Yes, I would agree. That's the word. You know, I posted something on my page that I tagged you on, and that was the little scene from Nomads. She's in this movie as part of a pack of people. She doesn't have one word, doesn't say a word, but she does this dance. And your written response was, oh, my God. Remember that?
I vaguely remember it, but I need to be reminded of it. If it's Mary Warnoff doing a crazy dance, I'm all for it.
On top of an automobile in a black shimmy dress.
Oh.
It's what, like, oh, my God. It's called Nomads. Nomads. It's with Pierce Brosnan and Leslie Ann Down.
Oh.
And Adam.
Okay, that Nomads. Okay, that Nomads. I thought it might have been an earlier, like a mid-70s. Okay, so this is more like...
No.
Okay.
This is like 86, 85, 86, something like that?
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah. Mm-hmm. I remember that movie. I remember of that movie. I've not seen that movie. But now that I know, I will definitely be seeing that movie.
Yeah, but as I said, she doesn't have a word in it. She doesn't say one line. But she has that little two-minute scene, and it's like the temperature goes up to 200, and you are sweating. Seriously.
Right. Yeah, no, I get that. Yeah. No, I totally get that.
You know, but absolutely. For me, what that shows me about Lloyd Kaufman, okay, for better or worse, he could have gone in a different direction than Troma. I don't know if he would have been as successful. I certainly think that his personality and everything, you know, that Troma was the right decision. But that shows you that he was, I don't want to say serious filmmaker, but that he had technical ability to do other things. And throughout Troma, there are certain movies where you can see that. I can see that in Kabuki Man. I can see that certainly in Tromeo and Juliet and various other films. But that's a film that you will not believe that Lloyd Kaufman is involved in. If you saw that and didn't know that Lloyd Kaufman was involved, you would not think that at all. Am I correct in that assessment?
Right. Absolutely. And the reason I know that for a fact is when I first watched Sugar Cookies, I think the name Lloyd Kaufman just went past me without me even, because Lloyd Kaufman is, you know, it's a brand name, but it's also something of a common name. It's not like a name that, like Oliver Stone, for example, like his name popped out. I was like, oh, Oliver Stone. But for whatever reason, Lloyd Kaufman, his name didn't even register until after the movie was over with. And I went to the extras and I was like, oh, wait, no, that Lloyd Kaufman. Oh, wow. No, it really sort of like turned me around because no, this is not at all what I would associate a Lloyd Kaufman production being. And given the fact that he was the executive producer on this and wrote it, I mean, it's got a level of seriousness that you just don't get in any other Lloyd Kaufman, you know, enterprise at all. And so I was, I was very surprised. And by the way, I should say, I did not ask him at all about any of the three hardcore films that he directed.
No,
I was sort of dying to see them. I know one of them. One of them was with Vanessa Del Rio. I can't remember which one, but one of them, she was the star. So that I would be fascinated to hear. Lloyd Kaufman directing Vanessa Del Rio. Just that sounds like a story and a half. But you know, I didn't ask.
One of these days, because I would like to see those. But getting back to Sugar Cookies, I do want to say something about Lynn Lowry. Lynn Lowry was only in a handful of films, but one of the films that she was in was The Crazies, which is George Romero. And she has one of the most affecting and unusual deaths in that film. And she's very reserved. And to see her in Sugar Cookies and what she has to do and so on and so forth and the plot, you know, that's a very brave woman, and she's a good actress. She ended up doing cabaret singing in Las Vegas and L.A., and she actually has a couple of albums out on, I'm sure, like, and you can even find her on Spotify, Lynn Lowry. But I just wanted to at least give her some props too, because I think she's really good in that.
Oh yeah. And she's a very nice lady. I've met her before and I talked with her at length, because she's at that point where when she goes to conventions, because of the kind of way conventions, you know, kind of draw in younger crowds, not a lot of people are kind of at her table. So my friend and I got to hang out and talk with her for a long time because there wasn't anybody else around her. And she was just a really, really sweet lady. And you're right about her role in The Crazy. She's great in that. I believe Sugar Cookies is her first role, and it's 90% naked, like completely naked. So that, yes, that takes some kind of bravery for sure. But I'll tell you what else she's in that I want to recommend to everybody out there that might care and want to be listening, is that she's very, very great in Radley Metzger's Score, which came not too long before or after Sugar Cookies. I mean, and she's great in that movie, and Radley Metzger is a, you know, great, great filmmaker. So if you can find Score, check that out. She's great in that.
Mm-hmm. So Patrick, before we go, why don't you do a little bit of promotion on yourself and tell us what you're doing and what you're writing and where we can find it and all that sort of good stuff.
Okay, well, I'm kind of wrapping up my Russ Meyer run this Friday. I just published my Cherry, Harry, and Raquel piece on Monday, and my Beyond the Valley of the Dolls piece will be coming down on Friday. I'm posting one Meyer piece on Mondays and Fridays as I go through his filmography in chronological order. So I'm wrapping it up. I probably got about 4 weeks left. And in the meantime, I'm still doing my usual rotation of directors. I just added a piece on Dementia 13, as I've added Francis Ford Coppola to the rotation, and so I'll be going through his movies. And I also will keep going through my hardcore pornography reviews, and tomorrow I will be dropping Water Power, the essay on John Costello's shocking 1976 film with Jamie Gillis. All of these essays can be found at my site, which is apollotwin.com, and it's a pretty easy navigation-wise. Just go over there and click around and read to your heart's content. I'm always putting new content on there every week, at least two pieces a week. I try for three pieces a week, and sometimes if I'm really, really on fire, I'll put five pieces, but mostly three. But always new content every week. Go over there and check it out. It's a good time.
Okay, repeat the Facebook page and the URL.
The website is apollotwin.com, and that's Apollo like, you know, the god, and twin as in there's two of us. So apollotwin.com. You can follow me on Facebook or my, you know, Patrick Crane. I have a Facebook group, Apollo Twin. I got to reset the privacy controls on that because it's hard to find, and I have to add people to it, and I need to make that a little more accessible. But there's also the Apollo Twin over on Instagram with me, and then I'm Apollo Twin over on Twitter. So I'm all over the place. I'm on all the social medias. So go check it all out.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I recommend Patrick's writing. You know, no question. Definitely read his stuff. And I also post his material. By the way, you are now pre-approved at Film and Stuff. I don't even have to approve you anymore. But you can see his stuff on both the Incredibly Strange Films page and also Film and Stuff, which is our sort of like smaller sister that I basically am admitting now, along with doing the admin work for Deviant Legion and ISF podcasting. So that's what we're doing there. We've got a show coming up tomorrow. And Vicky and Rachel and my ex-partner Steven and I are going to be doing an Oscar redux. We're going to be talking about the Oscars. And I'm going to tell you, if you're going to listen to it, strap yourself in because it's going to be a bumpy ride. Okay, so we're going to do that tomorrow. And that's Wednesday at 8 p.m. EST, Eastern Standard Time, or whatever they call this now, whatever. Then on Saturday at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, we are going to be doing on April, the month of April, we'll be focusing on comedy because we have April Fool's Day and so on and so forth. We have Tax Day that we have to deal with, and you can only laugh about that to get through it. So we're going to be focusing basically on comedy in that. So on Saturday, we are going to focus on Down the Rabbit Hole with Rachel. We'll be talking about and listening to stand-up routines and comedy skits and things like that. So we'll be doing that on Saturday. On Sunday, I'm not sure exactly what TC is doing, but we've got Rock This Town with TC, our radio show, on Sundays at 8 o'clock for an hour. And he had a special last week that he did on the person who passed away in the Foo Fighters. So I think this week, I'm not sure exactly what he's doing. Now on Monday, and I do believe it will be this Monday, we have a new show coming up along with Doc and Joey Vento. And they're going to be talking about doing their shows every 2 weeks, classic horror and sci-fi from the silent era until about the 60s, and that's what they'll be dealing with, and that'll be a new show that we're having. We have a couple other things that we're planning. Vicky and I will be doing another intense show. Probably not next week, but the week after. And I do have a show on April 13th. We're going to be very, very pleased to welcome back author Joe Lansdale. And Joe Lansdale will be talking about his new book, which I have in front of me. I just got it today. Born for Trouble, The Further Adventures of Hap and Leonard. So we'll be talking about that. And he has some other things planned. He also, I just happened to watch a film that he executive produced called The Pale Door, which is on Shudder, by the way. I suggest you watch it. And I know I'll be bringing that up. We did a podcast with him promoting that before it was released. But now that I've seen it, I want to bring it back up and let people know to watch it. And I'm sure we'll be talking about some of his other work, like Bubba Hotep and that. But he'll be coming on with us on the 13th of April. We've got a lot more coming, but nothing set in stone yet. So that's what we have basically said at this point. You want to keep along with us. And Patrick, if you have any ideas of things like as far as a commentary watch or anything you want to do, just let me know. We'll definitely get you in, and you're always, always welcome here at Deviant Legion. You're part of the family as far as I'm concerned.
Thank you very much, Carl. I will very much let you know, because I have a few ideas in the back of my head rolling around, especially now that I've got a little bit more free time than I did 2 weeks ago.
Yes, understood. Well, listen, we want to really congratulate you on your Q&A and your meeting with Lloyd Kaufman, and may there be lots more surprises for you and the and before we go, just talk about the Oklahoma City film group that you co-admin, or however you want to say that.
Yes, the Oklahoma Film Society is an organization. It's been around now for about 10 years almost. Started off as the Oklahoma City Film Club, or OKC Film Club, and we used to have a few more members that were sort of in, you know, sort of executive roles, for lack of a better term. But really now it's just myself and a guy named Alex Palmer, and we get help from a guy named Kevin Tudor, and sometimes a gentleman by the name of Rodney McKinley. But generally it's just Alex and I that do these screenings down on Film Row in Oklahoma City, which is a section of our town, which we have an old screening building that used to be owned by Paramount Pictures. It's called the Paramount. And what it used to be was a hub where a lot of distributors from the territories would come and screen movies as they came in off rail carts. And the screening room is still intact. It's still one of the few screening rooms of its kind still intact. It's been refurbished and everything like that, but the seats are still original. And we screen movies there every, I think, other Thursday. Our schedule is certainly currently in flux. We're making some changes to our lineup and how we're going to be doing movies. So a lot of that right now is in flux, and we may even be moving locations. But for right now, that's basically what it is. It's just two of us, and we show movies every month, and we really have no rhyme or reason as to what we show. Sometimes they're, you know, themed with, Black History Month, or with, you know, in June we'll do, you know, we do a lot more gay pride stuff. And then in October we generally do horror marathons and stuff. And Christmas time we do some Christmas shows. So, you know, it's pretty much themed throughout the year, but for the most part, they're pretty random picks altogether. But that's what it is, and I enjoy doing it. It's a lot of fun.
Absolutely. And so if you're ever in the Oklahoma City territories, please look Patrick up and go to one of his screenings. That'd be great. All right, folks, we want to thank Patrick again for coming on with us. We want to thank you for listening. And I guess it's about time to say good night. So shall we say good night, Patrick?
Absolutely. Good night,
all
everybody.
Right, folks. Good night. Enjoy. And we'll see you soon. All right.